Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today is a rather special day because we're talking about what some people would call a young adult novel. Shouldn't really be called. It's a huge book, which is a picture book and a silent movie and a novel. It's over 500 pages long, but many of those pages, I would say almost two-thirds, are pictures, and it's called The Invention of Hugo Cabret. It's by my guest, Brian Selznick, and it's published by Scholastic Press. Now, it's about a boy, Hugo Cabret, who lives hidden in a train station. His father was the clockmaster there, and he now, after his father's death and his uncle's disappearance, is keeping track of the clocks, filching things from the shops in the station to stay alive, and trying to repair an automaton, a robot-like thing that his father rescued from a museum that will eventually have a message for him and which will lead him into the entire world of French filmmaking in the form of the magnificent Trip to the Moon by an early French filmmaker, Georges Méliès.
Méliès.
Now, tell me, how did this start? This is a bit complicated.
Yeah, it all started with A Trip to the Moon, with the Méliès film. I think I had seen it years and years ago, and I found it really kind of magical and odd. And it was made in 1902. It's considered the first science fiction movie ever made. And it has that iconic image of the rocket going into the eye of the man in the moon that a lot of people would recognize. And I had seen it and found out that Méliès was a magician originally, and that kind of intrigued me. And I just thought it would be interesting to one day write a story about a kid who gets to meet Georges Méliès. And that idea basically sat in the back of my head for many, many years until I read a book called Edison's Eve by Gabby Wood. And that book is about the history of automata and these wind-up mechanical figures. And there was a whole chapter about Méliès, and it said that Méliès owned a collection of automata that he loved, but at the end of his life, when he lost his money, he donated them to a museum that promised to take care of them, but they didn't, and the automata were destroyed and thrown away. And when I read that, I imagined a kid finding one of those broken automata in a pile of garbage in Paris. And that was really where all of this began, was with that image of that kid.
Well, what led me to be fascinated, there's a novel by that guy, Villiers de l'Isle-Adam, who wrote Axel's Castle, a classic decadent novel called The Eve of the Future, in which Thomas Edison and robots and all kinds of decadent behaviors occupy the center of the novel. So when I saw that this was the subject matter here, I thought, oh, well, this is my kind of thing. You also had done a book, The Boy with a Thousand Faces, that imagines a boy as a kind of Phantom of the Opera type, able to transform into various movie monsters. So movies are very much a part of your imagination of children's books, yes?
Yeah, no, I've always loved movies. I've always loved watching movies. And when I was a kid, the original Phantom of the Opera with Lon Chaney was one of my favorite movies. And I remember very clearly sitting on the far side of my parents' bed with my eyes just kind of peeking over, watching this movie and screaming when the mask is pulled off the Phantom of the Opera. And so that was always something that I really loved. And so the way movies tell stories always intrigued me. And I've always seen a sort of connection between that kind of visual storytelling and what happens in books when you turn the page. So movies have always been very important.
And to your family, too, as I understand it.
Yeah. David O. Selznick, who produced Gone with the Wind and King Kong and Rebecca, was my grandfather's first cousin. And they grew up together, hated each other, never spoke for the rest of their lives to each other. But And my grandfather and David O. Selznick both died before I was born. But my grandmother, when I went to visit her, her house was filled with books about David O. Selznick. And as she got older, David O. Selznick and my grandfather grew closer and closer until towards the end of her life. They were best friends and they had always loved each other, even though that's not entirely accurate. She also said that all the furniture in her house was from the Smithsonian Institution, which wasn't accurate either. Uh-huh. But because of that and seeing all these books about David O. Selznick and growing up watching the original King Kong, it was always a real thrill to see my last name at the beginning and the end of all of these movies. So,
now, as I understand it, you arrive at making children's books in a circuitous way. You studied at the Rhode Island School of Design, but went after school to work at a children's bookstore, Eeyore's Books, where the head of the bookstore endeavored to give you an entire education in children's books.
Yeah, Steve Geck, who was the manager at the store and who's now an editor at HarperCollins, he sort of took pity on me because after college, when I decided I wanted to get into children's books, I knew nothing about children's literature. And I got all through college avoiding children's literature because – actually, it was because in high school people used to tell me I should illustrate children's books. And so that made me, I think, very much not want to do that when I was in college. And I didn't really know anything about children's books. And Chris Van Allsburg and David McCauley taught at my school, and I avoided them. And Sendak came to speak, and I didn't go hear him. But after college, I kind of came to my senses and realized this is what I should be doing. And so Steve, who grew up in a children's bookstore, knew everything about children's books, would send me home every day with bags of books. And it was in reading all of those books that I began to first understand the possibilities of children's literature and how experimental and exciting and beautiful it is and what can happen with the form of the book and how the page turns in a picture book make you aware of the art form that you're holding, that that thing in your hands isn't just a way of getting a story across, but it is actually part of the storytelling process itself. And that really fascinated me.
Well, one of the first things one notices when one opens The Invention of Hugo Cabret by my guest, Brian Selznick, is influence. The book begins with a sequence, and these pictures are done in sequences, almost film sequences. Some people have said storyboards, but I think they're much more complete than that. But one of the things that Maurice Sendak, the author of Where the Wild Things Are, discovered about storytelling was that the size of the picture in relation to the page is a way of bringing the reader into the book, that if page by page, as you turn it, the picture gets bigger and bigger on each successive page, it feels as if you're falling into the picture, that the picture is surrounding you. And here we begin Sendak style, but also movie style, with an aerial view of Paris.
Yeah, and Sendak, in Where the Wild Things Are, where he does start with a small drawing, you know, where it says, on the night Max wore his wolf suit, he made one kind of mischief and another. Those drawings, as they grow and take over the book itself, it parallels what's happening to the main character, what's happening to Max. And I was thinking a lot mostly about The Wild Rumpus, where you finally get to The Wild Rumpus when Max is on the land, you know, the place where the wild things are, and there's no words and there's no white space, and you turn the pages and move through The Wild Rumpus with Max. But someone recently pointed out to me that the very first drawing in Hugo is a very small image of that moon, and it's like the screen of the movie theater is very far away. And then as you turn the pages, like you were describing, the pictures themselves grow and grow. And I didn't even realize that I was paralleling what Sendak had done in Where the Wild Things Are. But that's exactly where it came from, was from that sort of opening. And I was picturing it like a zooming shot, like where we're moving into the movie camera, to the movie screen. And we then fall into the city of Paris and then meet all of the main characters. And I think it's 44 pages of pictures that get the story started, and Sendak was definitely a big influence on that.
Not only Sendak, but also as we travel through the book, we see kind of reminiscences of those French films about children that have helped shape this imagination. most notably a film that we must have in common, the great short film by Jean Vigo called Zero for Conduct, which is a surrealistic rendering of a revolution in a boys' school, complete with almost religious pillow fight.
It is the most glorious pillow fight ever filmed.
Yes. And the other film latent here is the Truffaut film, The 400 Blows. So that this book begins, in a sense, in an idea about childhood itself, that the child is independent, mm-hmm. an orphan, and that his job, in a way, is to circumvent authority mm-hmm. and find out in the course of growing up, in the course of the invention, literally, of Hugo Cabret, he has to learn the difference between who is a dangerous adult authority figure and who is, in fact, a mentor and a friend.
Yeah, and a lot of that grew out of the watching, especially of the François Truffaut film. But I came to the Truffaut film, The 400 Blows, through Jean Vigo. And one of my boyfriend's favorite movies is La Talante, another film by Jean Vigo. And that then led me to Zero for Conduct. And I started watching all of these because I knew the book was going to take place in Paris in the early 1930s. And these the Vigo films are from the early 1930s. And Zero for Conduct, I then found out, was a big influence on Truffaut when he was making The 400 Blows. And I had heard of The 400 Blows, and when I found out that it was about a 12- or 13-year-old kid who, you know, strikes off on his own in Paris after, you know, his parents don't understand him and he runs away and he tries to steal things, there were a lot of parallels with the story that was formulating in my head for Hugo. And so that idea of the power and the resilience of children that I see in a lot of the works by Truffaut, and I later saw a movie called Small Change by Truffaut, which is really incredible, and his understanding of the depth of children and what they're capable of was something that very much informed how I saw Hugo.
Now, the theme of this book is something that, to use Sondheim's words, is putting it together. Mm-hmm. And its climax comes as little Hugo explaining not just the automaton which he's managed to put together, but since he's been winding clocks, he's looking from the roof at Paris itself, and he mm-hmm. understands that the city itself is a machine. And I thought I'd ask you to read the end of the sixth chapter.
Sure.
In which he explains his vision of the world.
Sure. Hugo says, "Sometimes I come up here at night, even when I'm not fixing the clocks, just to look at the city. I like to imagine that the world is one big machine. You know, machines never have any extra parts. They have the exact number and type of parts that they need. So I figure if the entire world is a big machine, I have to be here for some reason. And that means you have to be here for some reason, too." Hugo's talking to his friend Isabel. And then it concludes by saying, "They watched the stars, and they saw the moon hanging high above them. The city sparkled below, and the only sound was the steady, rhythmic pulse of the clock's machinery." Hugo remembered another movie he and his father had seen a few years earlier, where time stops in all of Paris, and everyone is frozen in their tracks. But the night watchman of the Eiffel Tower and some passengers who land in an airplane are mysteriously able to move around the silent city. What would that be like? Even if all the clocks in the station break down, thought Hugo, time won't stop. Not even if you really want it to. Like now.
Ryan Selznick, reading from The Invention of Hugo Cabret. Now, after our break, I want to talk to you about that sense of storytelling in which everything plays a part versus another kind of storytelling, which I think is of equal importance. But meantime, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Brian Selznick, author most recently of the huge picture book, graphic novel, silence movie compendium, The Invention of Hugo Cabret, published by Scholastic Press. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Brian Selznick about the invention of Hugo Cabret. Now, many things do fall into place in the course of this book, and I found myself thinking that while I enjoyed that, I enjoy as much and sometimes more the things that don't fall into place, dreams that remain uninterpretable, or the fabulous sections of novels that are purely digression, where the reader afterwards has to imagine what it was that put this part of the book in. So I'd like you to make your plea for the Clockwork novel.
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of mystery and things that are unexplained. And my first book, The Houdini Box, ended without ever finding out what was inside the Houdini Box. And that was very key for me because I wanted the reader to be part of the story. And with this, I think because so much of the book was about the idea of machinery and the idea of clockworks, and that idea with that passage that I read where the machines having everything in them to make them work, and that Hugo sees himself as and the world in that way, that I wanted the book itself to have that kind of structure. And that's why the book it's divided in half with 12 chapters in each half, like a day. And I think that within the structure of itself, that part of having the pictures tell the story, at least for me, leaves a little bit of that open, because I agree, like, I don't want everything to be solved. I don't want everything to be to fall into place quite too perfectly. And but yet it was important for me that all of the elements in the story relate to everything else in the story, and for it to come together for Hugo, because that's part of what his journey is and what he's trying to find. And for me, in a lot of ways, it's also about becoming an artist, what it means to be an artist and to see the world in that way. And that is often a very messy thing. And I think for me, by having the pictures be something that is that you read narratively, but they're also open to interpretation. I'm not telling you specifically with the images. I'm allowing you to come into the story itself and to watch what's happening, that there's a certain openness with that that hopefully will give it a little bit of that breathing room, as it were. But at least for Hugo and for this specific story, I felt like I needed everything to relate in the structure of the story itself, like the machinery that Hugo himself is so obsessed with.
My teacher, Hugh Kenner, once observed that at the time of this novel, the world had in it machines whose workings you could understand simply by looking at them. If you look at the pendulum of a clock and the set of cogs and wheels that are part of its system, or if you look at the automata, you'll understand how it works. A typewriter, another example. You see how this machine works by examining it. That we move into a different idea of the world, he suggested, as soon as transistorization occurred. That you couldn't look at a transistor radio and understand its workings any more than you can at a computer to understand how what happens in it happens. So this plot that you've made is what Kenner would call a homemade world, a world in which vision can help you to understand what's around you. In other words, it's a world in which a child is taken care of by his eyes. Because this book seems to be an advocate for a world in which a child will come to feel at home by understanding its workings.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is about what Hugo sees and how he interprets what the world around him through what he can feel with his fingertips and what he can make and what he can understand. And when I was a kid, I didn't have this affinity for machines. And I guess the parallel between me and Hugo is that I drew and I tried to interpret what I saw and what I imagined onto paper. And for Hugo, you know, what he's able to do is fix anything. And there's that ability, like you were saying, to see something and understand it by looking at it. And also for Hugo with the machinery, by listening to it, by giving himself over to the machine itself. And that he is in a world where everything is accessible to him in that way. And I think he then has to struggle eventually with understanding the difference between fixing something and creating something new. And so I think maybe because he's living in this world where he is able to understand the machines and he is able to fix them and bring them in a way back to life, that he is then later able to take all of those elements and figure out what it means for him to then create something that didn't exist in the world before, that is completely new to the world. And so that's why the first half of the book is about fixing that machine, that automaton that he finds that had this connection with his father. And then the second half of the book is about him and Isabel, the goddaughter of this old man, trying to fix the old man, trying to fix a person and what happens when, because machines have purposes, and what happens when people don't have a purpose, what happens when they lose their purpose. And so that idea comes back with people.
Well, Meyers is one of the examples of a person whose work was almost lost. Mm. Do you want to explain how that came to be?
Yeah, Méliès was an amazingly prolific and famous filmmaker. I think he made like 500 movies. And when other filmmakers began making movies, they quickly discovered that you could move the camera and do all these exciting things with the camera. But Méliès, because he had started off as a magician, always pictured the screen as the proscenium of his magic theater. And so he never moved the camera. And it eventually came to seem very static and old-fashioned, even back in the teens and early 20s. And he eventually lost everything. World War I came about. And in order to make money, a lot of the way he did that was he sold the old film stock that he had so that it could be melted down and turned into shoe heels and combs. So many, many, many of his movies were lost, and he ended up working in this toy booth, which was in a train station in Paris, and he worked there 7 days a week for many, many hours.
But now when we see a reconstructed Meyers film, we're astonished at their beauty, the way they, in a strange way, anticipate works like those of Joseph Cornell, the making of the dream world that's entirely generated by one man, although he had cameramen and such. Mm. He's a one-man show.
Yeah, it's his vision.
And
it was the surrealists who found him again at the toy booth where he was working in Paris. And it was the toy booth. It was the surrealists who got him a film festival again at the end of his life, and they found some of the movies that still existed that had not been destroyed. So he ended his life seeing that he had inspired all these other people and was celebrated again. But that connection between dreams and imagination was very clear to the surrealists and many, 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 many later artists in terms of seeing what Méliès had been able to do, you know, with the simplest of special effects back at the beginning of cinema.
Well, just as Méliès is the spiritual grandfather or godfather to this book and to Hugo Cabret, the man who sat for the pictures of Méliès in the book, a children's book artist, is your spiritual godfather, and I wondered if you would tell about him. His name is Rémy Charlap.
Yeah, Rémy Charlap is a really wonderful children's book writer and illustrator, and he's also a dancer and a choreographer, and he was a teacher for many years. And when I was a kid, some of my favorite books were by Remy Sharlip. And I remember very few of the books I had when I was a kid, but I remember Remy's very clearly. There was a book called Fortunately, and that whole book was about what happens when you turn the page, and a book called 13, which tells 13 simultaneous stories on every page. And when you turn the page, you see all 13 stories move to their next moment, and arm and arm and arm, and hand talk alphabet, which is how I learned the sign language alphabet. And a few years ago, I met Remy through a mutual friend, and Remy and I became really good friends. And whenever Remy lives in San Francisco, and whenever he would come to New York, we'd get together. And when I would go to San Francisco, I'd see him. And he was asking me a couple of years ago what I was working on. And I was working on this book. And I said, oh, this book about Georges Méliès. And I said that. And I looked at Remy. And I realized that Remy looks exactly like the photographs I've seen of Georges Méliès. And so I asked Remy if he would pose as the character in the book, because a lot of times I'll do sketches from my head of what I want the compositions to be for the drawings. And then I'll find people in real life who look like the characters, either real ones like Méliès or imaginary ones like Hugo. And then I'll ask them to pose in the positions that I've drawn from my head. And so Remy is Georges Méliès in the book. And I dressed him up in costume, and I took all these photographs. And I think why that became such a meaningful experience for me is because Remy has spent his entire life as an artist and teaching people that we are all artists. And because Méliès was someone who lost himself, who was no longer able to be an artist for many, many years, but at the end of his life is rediscovered, that the idea for me personally of having Remy Sharlip be Georges Méliès is that we don't ever lose that ability, that underneath we are still Remy Sharlip. Like that still exists underneath everything, no matter how bad things might go. And obviously for Georges Méliès, they went very badly for a while. But underneath that spirit of creativity of Remy Sharlip still exists.
I've been speaking with Brian Selznick, author most recently of The Invention of Hugo Cabret, published by Scholastic Press. Thank you, Brian, for joining me.
Thank you so much.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.